Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we explore new evidence comparing oral anticoagulants for acute venous thromboembolism, treatment for chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia, and early results of gene therapy for inherited deafness. We also examine evolving strategies for chronic lymphocytic leukemia, review the management of polymyalgia rheumatica, and present a case discussion of a woman with chest pain, dyspnea, and syncope. We explore gastric cancer prevention, competency-based billing, the health consequences of immigration enforcement, and access to high-cost gene therapies. And we present a perspective on good compressions. Bleeding risk with apixaban versus rivaroxaban in acute venous thromboembolism by Lana Castellucci, from the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute at the University of Ottawa, Canada, and co-authors. Venous thromboembolism is a common treatable condition, yet it is the third most common cause of acute cardiovascular events and cardiovascular-related death worldwide. Apixaban and rivaroxaban are the oral anticoagulants most frequently used to treat acute venous thromboembolism. However, owing to a lack of trials that have compared rivaroxaban with apixaban, clinical practice guidelines do not recommend one anticoagulant over the other. In this international trial, 2,760 eligible patients with acute symptomatic pulmonary embolism or proximal deep vein thrombosis were randomly assigned to receive apixaban or rivaroxaban for 3 months. In this trial, the primary outcome of the risk of clinically relevant bleeding was significantly lower with apixaban than with rivaroxaban during the 3-month treatment period. Lisa Moores, from the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, Bethesda, Maryland, writes in an editorial that the landmark trial by Castellucci and colleagues provides the first evidence from a randomized, head-to-head comparison to guide clinicians in choosing between the two most prescribed anticoagulants for acute venous thromboembolism. Despite its rigor, the trial has limitations. It was not powered to assess the significance of differences in the risk of recurrent venous thromboembolism. The trial population lacked racial and ethnic diversity, and the results may also not be generalizable to high-risk groups who were excluded from the trial. Finally, because data cover only the initial 3 months of treatment, whether these safety differences persist beyond 3 months remains unknown. Despite these limitations, the trial provides vital evidence for the treatment of venous thromboembolism. By confirming the safety advantage of apixaban over rivaroxaban in a randomized trial, these results should prompt a reevaluation of current guidelines. Apixaban is a safer first-line option than rivaroxaban for minimizing the risk of bleeding without compromising the prevention of recurrent thrombosis. Romiplostim versus placebo for chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia by Hani Al-Samkari from the University Hospital of Cologne, Germany, and co-authors. Chemotherapy-induced thrombocytopenia, CIT, is a common complication of chemotherapy that is associated with bleeding, reduced relative dose intensity, and potentially worse outcomes. No widely available therapies are approved for CIT. This Phase 3 trial involved 165 patients with persistent CIT, platelet count less than or equal to 85 times 10 to the 9th per liter on trial day 1, who were receiving multi-agent cytotoxic chemotherapy for gastrointestinal cancers. Patients were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive romiplostim or placebo for 3 chemotherapy cycles. Weekly romiplostim was effective in treating persistent CIT and preventing its recurrence in these patients. Compared with placebo, romiplostim resulted in a lower incidence of chemotherapy dose modifications. Adverse events that were considered by the investigators to be related to romiplostim or placebo occurred in 12% of patients who received romiplostim and in 7% who received placebo. with the most frequent being nausea and headache. George Goshua and Alfred Ian Lee from Yale School of Medicine, New Haven, Connecticut, write in an editorial that these sweeping results from Al-Samkari and co-authors usher in a potentially transformative era of growth factor treatment for CIT, providing a strong rationale for the use of romoplostim in chemotherapy for solid tumors when the risk of CIT is predicted to be high, with the goal of maximizing relative dose intensity. Despite the tremendous gains observed with romoplostim in the trial, a benefit with respect to overall survival was not seen. Of course, the potential for increased relative dose intensity to influence survival ultimately depends on the efficacy of the anti-neoplastic treatments used. In the future, maximizing relative dose intensity with treatment strategies in which immune priming synergizes with immunotherapy in select cancers may be a particularly salient testing arena for thrombopoietin receptor agonists in CIT. DB Otto Gene Therapy for Inherited Deafness by Vasily Valayanopoulos from Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Tarrytown, New York, and co-authors. Congenital deafness affects 1.7 per 1,000 babies born in the United States and is predominantly caused by genetic deficiencies. Biallelic pathogenic variants in OTOF, the gene encoding otoferlin, account for 1 to 3% of cases of congenital genetic deafness. Children with pathogenic variants in OTOF are typically born with profound deafness, and their hearing does not spontaneously improve. Despite their profound deafness, young children with otoferlin deficiency have cellular structures of the inner ear that remain intact. This study evaluated whether introducing otoferlin protein with the adeno-associated virus-based gene therapy DB-OTO that delivers human OTOF complementary DNA encoding otoferlin could restore natural hearing. 12 children with OTOF variants and profound deafness received an intracochlear infusion of DB-OTO in one or both ears. Profound deafness in these children was defined by an average audiometric threshold of greater than 90 decibel hearing level, indicating an inability to hear a gas-powered lawnmower. At week 24, the primary efficacy endpoint of a level of hearing that generally avoided the need for cochlear implants was found in 9 of 12 participants. 3 of the 9 participants had average normal hearing sensitivity after DB-OTO therapy. A total of 67 adverse events occurred or worsened during or after treatment, none of which led to discontinued participation in the study. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Paul van de Heining and Vincent van Rompuy from the Antwerp University Hospital, Belgium, write that the study by Valayanopoulos and co-authors shows the safety and feasibility of cochlear gene therapy. The significant improvements in hearing thresholds reported by Valayanopoulos are consistent with those in previous reports and are encouraging. The absence of serious adverse events further supports the safety profile of cochlear gene therapy. Several challenges warrant further research, including variability in outcomes among treated persons. One participant did not have a response and received a cochlear implant, and two others were slow to have a response. The extent to which the therapeutic effect is durable after a single treatment, and the appropriate timing of gene therapy delivery. The study will almost certainly elicit interest in treating other forms of genetic deafness with gene therapy, although the presence and functional integrity of an appropriate cell type, such as the inner ear hair cell, will be critical to success. Fixed duration versus continuous treatment for chronic lymphocytic leukemia by Othman Al-Sawaf from the University Hospital of Cologne, Germany, and co-authors. Treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL, currently consists of two main approaches, continuous therapy with Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors and fixed duration regimens combining venetoclax with either CD20 antibodies or Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. These authors conducted a comparison of these two therapeutic approaches. In a Phase 3 trial, 909 patients with previously untreated CLL were randomly assigned to receive continuous ibrutinib or fixed-duration venetoclax obinutuzumab or venetoclax ibrutinib. The fixed-duration venetoclax-based regimens were non-inferior to continuous ibrutinib with regard to 3-year progression-free survival and were associated with higher minimal residual disease, MRD, negative rates. Given the clinical advantages of treatment-free intervals, fixed-duration therapy may be considered in most patients with untreated CLL. Polymyalgia rheumatica. A review article by Christian Diaco from the Medical University, Graz, Austria, and Eric Matteson from the Teaching Hospital of the Paracelsus Medical University, Brunico, Italy. Polymyalgia rheumatica is an inflammatory condition that affects persons older than 50 years of age and is characterized by pain in both shoulders, with or without hip or neck pain, or both, and with pronounced morning stiffness. The condition is typically diagnosed on the basis of these hallmark symptoms along with elevated inflammation markers, erythrocyte sedimentation rate and C-reactive protein level, and ruling out other conditions such as giant cell arteritis. Glucocorticoids are the primary treatment and provide rapid symptom relief. The initial dose, usually 12.5 to 25 milligrams of prednisone equivalent daily, is gradually reduced, ideally over 12 months or less, although the disease course varies, and polymyalgia rheumatica may persist for a longer duration. Relapses are common and sometimes warrant the use of interleukin-6 receptor inhibitors or methotrexate to minimize glucocorticoid exposure. A 57-year-old woman with chest pain, dyspnea, and syncope. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Patrick O'Gara and colleagues. A 57-year-old woman with a history of polysubstance use disorder presented with 2 days of severe chest tightness, dyspnea, lightheadedness, and syncope after several weeks of cough, orthopnea, and progressive exertional dyspnea. On arrival, she was hypotensive, tachycardic, hypoxemic, pale, and somnolent, with elevated jugular venous pressure and distant heart sounds. Electrocardiography showed PR segment changes, and bedside ultrasonography revealed a large pericardial effusion with diastolic right ventricular inversion, consistent with cardiac tamponade. Urgent pericardiocentesis drained a large volume of bloody fluid. Ongoing hemorrhagic drainage prompted CT angiography, which demonstrated an aortic root pseudoaneurysm arising from the non-coronary sinus of Valsalva. Intraoperative transesophageal echocardiography revealed thickened valves, vegetation on the aortic valve, and a root abscess. Pathologic examination showed acute inflammation and septate fungal hyphae with acute angle branching. Cultures grew Aspergillus flavus. The final diagnosis was fungal endocarditis involving the aortic and mitral valves, complicated by an aortic root abscess and rupture, causing hemopericardium and cardiac tamponade. Helicobacter pylori screen and treat for gastric cancer prevention. IARC Working Group Report. A sounding board article by Jin-Young Park from the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, Lyon, France, and co-authors. Gastric cancer is the fifth leading cause of cancer-related death worldwide. The incidence of gastric cancer varies widely across world regions, with Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean having the highest incidence. In 2013, an IARC working group concluded that the continuing high global burden of gastric cancer and the feasibility of treating its principal cause thus make it a logical target for intervention and called for increased public health investment in gastric cancer control. it was recommended that countries consider implementing population-based H. pylori screen and treat programs, accompanied by scientific assessment of their processes, feasibility, effectiveness, and potential harms. However, despite the existence of these guidelines and recommendations, implementation has been met with hesitation and limited action. In 2025, the IARC refined their report. Considering the growing global burden of gastric cancer, driven by shifting demographics and epidemiologic trends, the working group unanimously agreed that implementation of H. pylori screen and treat strategies remains the most effective and resource-appropriate strategy for reducing this burden globally. Valuing care provided by residents and fellows toward competency-based billing. A perspective by Abbas Hassan and Jennifer Walji from Indiana University School of Medicine, Indianapolis. U.S. graduate medical education has gradually adopted a competency-based framework. This model includes a formal progression of supervision. Only after meeting defined educational milestones can trainees advance from direct supervision, which involves a teaching physician being physically present, to indirect supervision, which involves the physician being immediately available but not in the room. However, long-standing Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, billing rules are not aligned with this paradigm. As trainees become more competent and progress to indirect supervision, the clinical work they perform becomes unbillable, creating a wide gap between the services trainees provide and the revenue hospitals can receive. Residents and fellows deliver 80% of level 1 trauma care and 40% of hospital-based charity care nationally, and the value of the care provided by trainees often far exceeds the cost of training. These authors argue that a competency-based approach could define the circumstances in which trainees are authorized to provide reimbursable services autonomously. The authors propose that CMS should authorize competency-based billing for senior trainees in all specialties, that payers should participate equitably in financing the development of the physician workforce, and that CMS could allow technology-enabled oversight to satisfy the physical presence requirement. A modernized billing framework that recognizes competency, leverages technology, and equitably distributes costs could align payment with the value of care delivered by residents and fellows. Health consequences of immigration enforcement in U.S. communities. A perspective by Melissa Arguello-Belli from Portland, Oregon. Immigration enforcement operations, particularly large-scale raids by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, have far-reaching consequences for community health, healthcare access, and clinicians' ability to provide timely care. In the author's clinical practice, she has seen sharp increases in anxiety, school absenteeism, deferred visits, and acute psychiatric symptoms in students after enforcement events. Immigration enforcement is not merely a legal or political issue. It's a public health issue with measurable consequences in blood pressure readings, glycated hemoglobin levels, school attendance, and psychiatric symptoms. The uncertainty created by routine immigration enforcement practices deepens fear and destabilizes immigrant communities' ability to access care. These pressures also affect the healthcare workforce. Physicians, nurses, medical assistants, and receptionists, many of whom come from immigrant backgrounds, absorb the cumulative stress of caring for patients who are frightened, medically destabilized, or abruptly disconnected from care. Until policy aligns with realities observed in clinics and communities, the health consequences of enforcement will remain both severe and preventable. The Cell and Gene Therapy Access Model, A Vision for Future Development, a perspective by Abe Sutton from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Baltimore. The Cell and Gene Therapy, CGT, access model was launched in 2025 to leverage the collective negotiating power of participating states to secure arrangements with manufacturers of expensive gene therapies, tying price to patient outcomes. With cell and gene therapies consistently commanding list prices of more than $1 million, and U.S. expenditures projected to reach $21 billion in 2034, this impending wave of expensive therapies will place substantial financial pressure on both public and private programs. The CGT access model addresses this challenge. Under the model, if a Medicaid beneficiary who receives a covered therapy does not benefit from the therapy, the state Medicaid program will be entitled to a rebate from the manufacturer equal to a portion of the therapy's cost. Looking ahead, the Innovation Center will focus on therapies that could benefit a large enough number of eligible Medicaid beneficiaries, facilitate innovation while fostering market competition, and identify and remove barriers that patients face. By streamlining patient access, securing financial assurances for state Medicaid programs, and expanding access to these specialized drugs nationwide, the CGT access model aims to maximize patient benefit, foster a viable and competitive market for manufacturers, and improve access to therapies. Good Compressions, a perspective by Lena Becker from Penn State College of Medicine, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Push harder. It had been Lena's mantra for a decade. Acceptance into a prestigious honor society, publications, a 13-point mile run, all came from pushing harder. So when a machine told her to push harder, it sounded like an old friend. Before Lena met the machine, she met a young woman with smooth, unwrinkled skin and vibrant red hair lying motionless in a hospital bed, sedated with benzodiazepines and anti-seizure medications. Each morning, Lena said, "Hello, it's Lena again," then shone a bright light into the patient's pupils, one after the other. Late the first afternoon, Lena met the patient's husband and mother. They asked questions Lena couldn't answer. For 2 weeks, they received the same replies from physicians. "We don't know," and "more testing." One day, their rounds were interrupted by alarms from the patient's monitors, triggered by irregular cardiac rhythms. The whole unit stopped everything to attend to her. Lena stood outside, trying to answer the mother's questions, until a nurse pulled her inside to start compressions. Their patient's pulse had been lost. A shiny white pad was stuck to her bare chest, attached by a thin wire to a small machine haphazardly positioned on the bedside table. Lena pressed her hands into ivory skin, turning ashen. 1, 2, 3. "Push harder," the machine said. So Lena did, pushing to the beat of the Bee Gees in her head. "Good compressions," the machine said. 2 minutes. Someone took her place. "Push harder," the voice advised, and the nurse in front of Lena said she needed to switch out. Lena started the ritual once more. Then they switched. The attending turned to the husband and explained that they had done everything possible. The attending announced, "Stop compressions." The wail of a mother sounded in the hallway. The other student was with her, crying with her. But Lena wondered why she didn't feel anything. She walked away, noticing the odd quietness of her mind. Nothing. In the hallway, the husband said, "Thank you so much for taking care of her." A tiny ache leaked from a crack in the wall Lena had not realized she had built. She pushed hard at that wall to seal everything back in until she was home. In our images in clinical medicine, a 49-year-old woman presented with a 6-month history of an itchy lump on her vulva. Examination showed a painless purple mass originating in the labia minor on the left side. Histopathological analysis of a biopsy specimen led to a diagnosis of vulvar melanoma with vaginal extension. Vulvovaginal melanoma is a type of mucosal melanoma that arises from melanocytes in the genital tract. They are not associated with ultraviolet light exposure. At the time of diagnosis, mucosal melanomas are more often metastatic than cutaneous melanomas. In another image, a 74-year-old man was admitted to the hospital with a 3-week history of intermittent fevers, muscle aches, and vomiting. He reported having attended a 2-hour workshop in a historic stone cabin in Yosemite National Park in the late summer, 1 week before the onset of symptoms. Thin blood smears showed spirochetes. Following PCR testing, a diagnosis of soft tick relapsing fever was made. This recurring febrile syndrome is caused by the transmission of certain Borrelia species during the bite of a soft-bodied tick, which is typically not noticed by the patient. In a third image, a 73-year-old woman presented in shock with a 1-day history of malaise, dyspnea, and confusion. Vital signs and physical examination indicated shock. Dehemoglobinized red cells and bacilli were seen on a peripheral blood smear. Following review of cardiac tissue and blood cultures, a diagnosis of massive intravascular hemolysis from Clostridium perfringens bacteremia was made. This condition results from bacterial toxin release and is associated with very high mortality. Although the diagnosis is rare, clinicians may consider this type of in vivo hemolysis when treating patients with undifferentiated illness who are in shock and whose blood samples are grossly hemolyzed. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.